Welcome to the Best of the Conference Room 2023, where we look back at the highlights of last year and some of the incredible guests we've had. Welcome to the Conference Room, a weekly podcast where business leaders and growth experts kindly share their experiences, actionable tips, and secrets to successfully grow a business. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a five-star review. It'll really help us out. And I really hope you enjoy this week's episode. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to the Conference Room. Good afternoon and welcome to the Best of the Conference Room 2023. As we reflect on this past year and the posts many of us read from our network on Facebook, LinkedIn, for some, it was a year filled with positives. The start of a new career, a fantastic exit, maybe getting married or having a child. And for others, not quite so positive. Redundancy, a lengthy job search perhaps, even bereavement. In the world at large, we saw rising interest rates, rising unemployment, terror attacks, and war. But we also saw business growth, businesses pivot and thrive. Here in the conference room, we saw the most incredible growth in our download figures, almost doubling our audience, hitting the top 100 in countries around the world, and solidifying our place in the top 0.5% of all podcasts around the world. And we know exactly why. It's because of the incredible guests who've come in week after week to share their experiences and expertise. None more so than our first guest, Tom Riley. Tom is a three-time CEO who steered companies through seed to scale, through IPOs, acquisitions, and mergers. To put it bluntly, he's done the lot. I asked him, what makes a great CEO?
I was at a venture capital event in Monterey, California. And the guest speakers were Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, and Vice President Al Gore. And they sat us down at a table. There was 12 CEOs with these two, leaders. I mean, the ultimate of leaders, if you think of General Colin Powell and Al Gore, what he did. And Colin Powell asked a question. He says, let's go around the table and tell me when you've seen great leadership or define great leadership for me. And unfortunately, he started to his left and I was sitting to his right. So I was the last one to share ideas. And of course, all the great ideas were kind of taken by the time it got to me. And I basically said, I'll know I've been a great leader when I've put myself out of a job. And I will know that when I wake up one day and I look at my calendar and there's no pressing meetings on my calendar and I decide to show up to work at 10 o'clock. I get to 10 o'clock and my inbox is empty. And I decide to go to an early lunch and I take someone out for a two-hour lunch. I come back from lunch, my calendar is empty, my inbox is empty, and there's no pressing matters. When I've achieved that, I know I'm a great CEO because a CEO is supposed to put themselves out of a job. And we can talk about how to do that, but that I shared that at that meeting. And the look I got from Colin Powell was kind of like, what are you talking about? But we then delve into, you know, what I call the three operating principles of a CEO. But yeah, you really got to put yourself out of a job because ultimately, if you've got a great sales leader, a great engineer, a great CFO, a great product person, a great support person, and you're all aligned, there should be nothing left for a CEO to do. And that's why I always find my goal.
Wow, that's amazing. So you mentioned the three operating principles. What are they?
So these are the three things that a CEO, I believe, needs to do extremely well. The first is the CEO needs to make sure you have a strategy in place. And a strategy is not just one thing. At any point in time, at the stage of a company, there's two to four things that a company has to do extremely well for it to succeed in that coming year or that coming phase of the company. The CEO needs to make sure that the company has a strategy. Doesn't have to come up with it themselves, but needs to make sure that it's very clear what are we trying to accomplish. We can go down how to do that. The second thing is the CEO needs to make sure that everybody is aligned behind it. So if you've defined your top three or four things that you need to do as a company, you need to make sure everyone is aligned behind it, they buy into it, and they're pushing in that direction. That means your board, your executive team, every employee in your company, your customers and partners, all aligned behind what you're trying to achieve. And then finally, you need to continually adjust and make changes by measuring how you're achieving that strategy and making sure that you are continually heading towards it. So it's strategy, alignment, and adjustment.
That was Tom Riley. Matthew Andreani is the CEO of Mazebolt, a cybersecurity software vendor with a revolutionary method of preventing DDoS attacks. They started out as a traditional DDoS protection service provider. I asked Matthew how and why they made that pivot.
We won't be able to do both, because what we're telling the market is this old way of doing things is an old way. You think of it like the first generation. If you want to step up to the second generation and almost complete elimination of the possibility of ever having a damaging attack, you have to go in this direction. There is no in between.
So you needed to lead by example, effectively. You had to drink your own Kool-Aid.
Correct.
Right.
We had to cut. We had to say, you know, and like I said, that decision didn't come easily because it was very difficult. We had very lucrative contracts with some very nice sized enterprises. And unfortunately, when you make such a transition, when you're a first mover product of a product that's never been done before in that industry, a true first mover, even your buyers and your existing customers are sometimes not the same buyer now for the new product. And some of them may not have the appetite to actually take such a product. So you had to cut. You couldn't do the slow transition. It was like, you know, either you come with us or we're going to part. Right. It was one of the toughest decisions I've had to make in the company, but we did that, and that's what we did.
Kev Ely is the VP Emir of Logrhythm and is an expert at helping American companies grow and develop internationally. I asked him what the primary differences he has found between doing business in the US and across Europe.
Buying or selling technology in the US is very, very different to buying and selling technology in Europe and in the
respect.
UK, for that matter.
In what respect?
Well, in the respect of the attitudes and the mindsets from a customer, generally speaking, are very, very different. I'll give you an example. I often will participate and attend sales calls, and I have attended sales calls for years where they're in global organizations. And we have a stakeholder in the US who's very excited about the capability of the technology and actually, in a sense, wants to be sold to and buys into the benefit of what it can deliver and is opportunistic in an entrepreneurial as a mindset in that kind of enterprising sense in America. And that, you know, that is often, again, I know it runs a risk of being generalized, but that's often the nature of the mindset of business in America. And I know that doing business in New York is different to doing business in New Orleans, which is in turn different to doing business in San Francisco. But broadly speaking, taking into account the regional differences, that's the mindset. They transform that to the UK as an example, where generally speaking, in the UK, we are conservative, small c, and quite skeptical and quite sometimes dour and suspicious at times of the technology proposition, maybe cynical at times. So you have that dynamic. And then in Europe, in different countries, you have very different tendencies when it comes to purchasing technology. Some parts of Europe, a proof of value or proof of concept is absolutely essential. It's essential that the technicians actually get their hands on the technology and test it, you know, almost with, you know, without wanting to really have any kind of sales type interaction. In other parts of Europe, you have a very process driven approach, a very methodical approach to doing business. So I say that, Simon, in the context that there are these uniqueness and when it comes to an American company, it's, you know, wanting to launch in Europe, what counts for success in the United States is not necessarily going to drive the same success across, you know, even in the UK, let alone the rest of Europe. It's not a, to use an American term, it's not a cookie cutter approach. They have to take into account the regional differences. And I've seen it time and time again, and I've witnessed it and I've experienced it.
During the course of 2023, we've had many company founders and CEOs join us here in the conference room, each providing their take on what it takes to be a great leader. Ian Patterson, founder and CEO of Pluralock, joined me earlier this year to share his story and vision for great leadership. We discussed a unique challenge a CEO faces in contrast to other VP or C-level positions, in that any other leader would typically have done the jobs of the people they lead, where a CEO will likely be leading a group of people, the majority of whom will be doing jobs that the CEO won't have done themselves.
It's an interesting question. I think that from my own experience, because I've been fortunate to have a pretty varied background in terms of the functions that I have done, I won't say roles, but I'll just say functions. I think that there was a lot of familiarity with most parts of the business. So if I look at Exapic as an example, when you're bootstrapping a business of one person, by definition, you are doing everything. You are chief bottle washer. You're taking out the garbage, et cetera. And you're also, trying to stand up a Hadoop cluster. And you're also trying to make sure that your, $10 a month virtual server in the cloud isn't going to fall over and deploying uptime monitoring. And you're also doing sales and you're also doing marketing. But I do take your point. As companies grow and have more specialized functions, I've certainly not been a general counsel in the past. I've certainly not had extensive corporate finance experience in the past, although I would argue that by now I probably have. So I think that is a bit of a challenge. It's usually grounded, though. I mean, most founders, most CEOs that I know are really good generalists, and they might have one or two crafts that they've picked up. I mean, they might be a great marketer, they might be a great product person. I think in my case, I've always had a split between sales and technology. So, I mean, call me a chief pre-sales officer if you want. I think that in the same way that Steve Jobs was a product guy, you could kind of bucket him into the product category. I think you could probably bucket myself into a technical sales category, and not be too far off. But having said that, I think CEOs and founders are usually pretty good generalists. So that's the first part. You're just dangerous enough to know how much you don't know about a lot of individual functions. And then you supplement that with people ideally who are smarter and more experienced than you are. I mean, part of the joy that I have as a CEO is that I am intentionally looking for people who are more experienced, who are more qualified, whose job I certainly couldn't do at the levels that they are doing, and then adding those people to the team. And I think success actually looks like if I can add somebody who is more experienced, if they have more credentials, if they've worked in bigger businesses, done more deals, worked on harder problems than we are today, I have succeeded. And that's just how we look at all of the hires that we make at this level.
Melissa Mitchell is one of Australia's most sought-after social media marketing experts and specializes in helping small businesses turn their audience into paying customers. I asked her why followers don't necessarily turn into customers.
So first of all, your followers don't mean anything if they're not engaging. So okay. I'm going to debunk that. Yeah. So it doesn't matter how many followers you've got. If they're not engaging, it's not going to make anything. And just because you've got followers doesn't mean they see your content. So, yeah, it doesn't mean that your friends or your followers see your content. So that is the biggest thing that people get tripped up with. So your followers and friends do not automatically see your content.
Wow.
Yeah, 100%. That is the biggest mistake that people make. So engagement is what I work off, not followers and friends. And
when we say, and just so we can be really tight on our definitions, so engagement is people liking, commenting, and sharing.
It's also the stuff that you don't see. It's anything that the algorithm picks up as stopping and scrolling and reading.
Oh, Okay.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about, and I know we are going to talk about Reels because that's something I know you're really hot on, right? So just to kind of like jump into Reels for a nanosecond.
Yeah.
When you're talking about Reels, when you can look on Reels and you kind of scroll, stop, the algorithm goes, ah, Melissa just stopped on that reel. So the fact that she watched Simon's demonstration of a pair of scissors, next time Simon has something, I'll bring you back and I'll show it to Melissa. That's
That one's a little bit different because you can get like data on that for 3 second views and that sort of thing.
Right.
When I'm talking, that one you can, that's sort of measurable, but the algorithm can also pick up if you've stopped slightly and read text. So I'll give you an example. I've got a client and they're like, what's going on my page? It's crickets. I've got no likes, no loves, and no shares. So we went into the actual analytics and I said, look at your engagement. You're trumping it. And she's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And we can benchmark it against other people. So I'll just give you an example of that. It was a cafe, right? And she said, but look at this account. Look at their account. They've got 8,000 followers. I said, okay, let's look at their account. They've got 8,000 followers. And this account that I took over had 200 when they started. We got it up to over 500, right? I said, but look at this. And I've got software that can read other people's accounts and read the interaction. Their account, now on Instagram, if you've got anywhere between up to 4% engagement, it's good, right? It doesn't sound like a lot, but 4% is good. I read this. I said, okay, let's go analyze their account of 8,000 people. They had less than 1%. It was like 0.02%.
Wow.
For 8,000 people. I said, now let's look at your account that we've grown from 200 to 500 and they were up to 3%. Engagement, which is really good because it, like I said, if you get up to 4 to 5%, that's considered a good account, right?
And the other one had 0.02%.
Yeah, for 8,000 people. I said, so would you rather 8,000 followers with less than 1% looking at it? Or you've got an audience.
Yeah.
And so if they were in an auditorium, I've got an engaged audience. So that's what I mean, Simon, by it doesn't matter how many followers you've got, you've got to look at who's looking at your audience.
Carsten Willems is the founder and CEO of VMRay, a leading email security vendor that he started to deal with a mounting problem of malware. I asked him how he went about turning the solution to a problem into a successful company.
I'm a techie by heart, so that means I'm good with certain things. I'm very bad with other things, and therefore other things may be more important for other type of people. So what creates passion for me is, and I think I already indicated, I'm passionate about solving hard problems, the problems that no one else can, or only very, very few people out there can solve. That is one driver. So I care about deep technology. I don't care about being faster, gluing together open source components, being good in faking until you make it. These are all valid approaches. And very often you can build a more lucrative business probably than I am able to do. But in order to remain passionate, yeah, and over the time, over the course of 10 years, seeing that transformation where I no longer do technology things myself, but I'm a CEO, I can only do that if I'm passionate about the thing I'm doing. And that is solving very, very hard problems. And that requires deep technology. Yeah? So at a starting point, I think it is very, very good if you feel the pain of the problem yourself that you want to solve, right? So I was a security researcher, I was a security engineer, I was dealing a lot with malware, and I realized, hey, it's fun to reverse engineer a malware, but it's taking so much time and it's so complicated, right? So why not build a tool that is doing that in a fully automated manner, right? So I was originally one of the users of my own solution. But I think if you are in the industry, it gives you a much better understanding of the problem and how a solution should look like. But that's not the only thing. Being in the part of the industry also gives you some reputation. It gives you a community. It gives you a network of people that you can talk to get a better understanding of the problem. of the solution. And it also helps you a lot in getting early access to potential early adopters. Yeah, because you already earned their trust. They are much more willing to test your tool than if you were just coming from the outside. So I can only talk about a company that is built on a technology that I really understand, that I also understand why it is there, why I have seen the different evolutionary steps over the last two decades. And that is, at least for me, the only way how I can build a company like that. Now, I know there are many, many other approaches, but this is the way how I did.
Austin Armstrong is one of the highest profile social media marketers. You've probably seen his videos popping up on your feed, telling you about some really cool websites that seem illegal to know. I asked him how he exploded his social media presence so effectively in such a short period of time.
Yeah, a couple things. In particular on Facebook, it's when they rolled out professional mode on profiles. So anytime a new platform rolls out a new feature, it's a good idea to test it. And so that was one thing that really helped out. In that 9-10 month period, I went from 5,000 connections, I think, which is the maximum amount you can have as people you're connected to now I have 830,000 followers. And so all of these platforms have just shifted and adjusted a little bit. The other really key factor was a very subtle shift in how I created content. So I was creating a lot of useful videos or useful website videos, sharing digital marketing tips, sharing SEO tips. But that's right around when I took a proven winning style, which was the conversation style, where you're communicating valuable information and you're sort of side profile viewed. You're talking to yourself in a different outfit. So it's like, you are the expert. You're communicating information to the viewer, and the viewer sitting in on this conversation. And so I took that style and applied it to the type of content that I was already creating, the useful websites, and I sort of remixed this style and made it my own. So it made it something fresh, something that people really hadn't seen before, but also felt very familiar because it was based on that proven winning style. And that really exploded for me. That helped me explode on YouTube. It took me 3 years to get to 5,000 subscribers. And then with one video, it exploded. And in 3 days, I went from 5,000 to 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. And it really hasn't slowed down all that much. I'm at about 580,000 subscribers on YouTube right now. And some little psychological tricks that I've been doing and working in with my content as well is that I found that it's easier to get negative engagement on your posts than it is to get positive engagement on your posts. And the platforms don't care if the engagement is positive or negative. They just want more engagement. And so I've sort of leaned into that a lot to increase my engagement dramatically, whereas the subject matter of my videos is still educational, it's still helpful, but I plant little secret Easter eggs throughout the videos that elicit an emotional response that always get a ton of comments. And those two things really helped me explode over the last 9-10 months.
Laura Belmain is the CEO of cybersecurity vendor SafeStack, a leader in application security solutions. I asked her how startups can successfully hire their first team members.
In all honesty, I screwed it up a number of times in those first few hires. I'd say probably 4 bad hires in the first 2 years. And when I say bad, I don't mean bad people. Yeah, absolutely. It was you yourself, Simon. I was just too polite to mention it. They're not bad people, let me clarify, but they weren't a good fit. Now, initially, I did what every founder does. So I was like, okay, who do I know? Who are my friends? Who can I hire? And you go, you tap your network. But what I found was my net was all security folk, and I love my folk dearly, but we're not necessarily the right people to build a product company. And so some of the expertise that I needed, they were coming from organizations that had $120,000 minimum contract size. They were selling to giant organizations. And that's not our world. We're product-led growth. We have no minimum seat size. Our smallest customer is like $300, and our biggest is over $500,000. And, so it's a huge gap from where my natural circle of friends was. And so I learned very quickly that just because I knew someone and liked them as a person, it didn't mean they were the right fit for the company and what we needed. And so I started branching further afield. Now we do our advertising very broadly, intentionally, and not just through friendship channels. And the most important thing we put in place was the cultural fit check. So we have a whole range of roles because we have a lot to do. But the first thing that we do in our interviews before we look at your skills at all is try and understand you as a person. Not that you have to be the same as us. None of us are the same. You know, our youngest person is 18. Our eldest is 55. We like all sorts of things from comic books to we've got some gym people who are like crazy fit and run ultra marathons. That's not me, by the way. We're a really diverse bunch, but we share values and we share the ability to be open in our communication, to give and receive feedback, to use data to back up decisions, to handle conflict. So those things, in all honesty, have been more important to us than the lived experience in role in these first few years, because we can teach a lot of things. Somebody could bring skills and experience we need, but if they're a bad cultural fit, it causes pain.
Brooke Young is one of the most prolific PR consultants working today. Her clients are the leaders of some of the most exciting and fastest growing businesses around the world. She came into the conference room to talk all things PR and how companies can harness the power of PR to propel their business. She pointed out that while most businesses understand the power and importance of marketing, that doesn't always extend to PR. I asked her what the difference was between the two.
Sure. So if you kind of think, I always describe it like sisters. I'm a big sister girl. So if you have two sisters, marketing and advertising is one of those sisters, and PR is the other one. Let's start with marketing and advertising, all kind of the same situation. If marketing says, well, marketing does say, I am good, buy from me. PR tells you the story of why you should buy from them. So with PR, we're not saying I am the best public speaker in the entire world. That is what marketing would say to try to get sales, because the ROI on marketing is sales, right? I have a degree in marketing too. So ROI on marketing is sales. PR, the ROI is a little bit more fluid. It's going to be impressions. It's going to be sales related. It's going to be clicks on your website. It's going to be followers on your email list, awareness, things like that. And that story would look like when I was 7, I began publicly speaking. I love to educate on topics like this and this and this. With all of XYZ happening in the world, I believe it's relevant. So I don't want to take this in a dark direction, but it's the only example I have right now. Right. For example, if somebody educated, let's say on mental health, let's say she spoke to mental health for colleges and high schoolers, in light of the things that have happened in the world, especially Michigan State, where they had another recent mass shooting, she could say, with all that's happening in the world, I want teens to know how to take care of their mental health. I want to break it down. I want to give actionable steps. And here is how. With PR, I am often saying, this person has actionable steps. This person can break it down. This person can help. The difference is marketing would say, I am the best.
Robert Freeman is the VP sales of global cybersecurity vendor SafeBreach and a career sales leader. He has spent his career going into regions and building them up from scratch. I asked him what the secret was to his success.
Yeah, really good question. I mean, there's so many facets to this answer, but I think I would start off by saying, like anything, you need a plan. Nobody does anything without a plan. You can't just go out there and knock on doors and say, I got this great widget I want you to buy. You need to have a plan, right? And part of that plan has to be, what is the market for your solution, the addressable market? And it's not just how many global 2000s or Fortune 1000s are there in a certain area, but you know, who's your competition? I think a big thing like what we do here is within the global, 2000 or Fortune 1000, which of those are more mature, which are medium mature maturity level, because a solution may require very mature sales, a very mature security organization, or maybe it requires just a basic security. So then you can start kind of fine tuning. So it's not just how many Fortune 1000s. It's not just the vertical. Is it finance? Is it healthcare? But what is the maturity level of who I'm going to target? And within those targets, who has my competition? They can really whittle it down to be focused. That's part of your plan. This is who I want to go after. I think that's important. Another thing that, you know, and I've done this before, is you go out and talk to a friendly. You know, people you've sold to before. It's not to sell them. You make it clear from the beginning, but it's get their feedback, right? These are the people that would be buying your solution, but hey, who should I be talking to within the organization? Tell me how the message sounds. Ask for 30 minutes of their time. Get feedback and continue honing that message. I think that's very important. So now, in a sense, you've got your external. I'm working here on my message. You know, does it resonate? Does it not resonate? So I think that's really important, both of those things.
Barbara Arman is the Chief Product Officer of Anatech, a company currently in stealth mode. And when he came into the conference room, was Chief Product Officer of Viridium. We talked about how a company builds a product. I asked him what a product team does and the role of a Chief Product Officer.
Excellent, excellent question. So product teams really are, you know, they're the heart, they're the product, they are what a vendor, you know, a identity and security vendor, cybersecurity vendor is taking to the market, right? Now, if you're a consulting company, your product is your services. But as a product vendor, what we're taking to the market is a solution to a problem.
Okay.
So the product team's responsibility is to, one, you know, listen to customers, listen to what the feedback is from the customers, listen to the market, because sometimes the feedback from the market is different than the feedback from the customers. It's not different like it's, it's not. It's not different like it's opposite, but it's different in the sense that, you know, your customers might be focused on solving a tactical problem that they have today, while the market is looking to solve a problem that is going to be, you know, that is in development or that needs to be solved tomorrow. So it's a slightly different way of looking at things.
Chen Bershan is the CEO of Skyhawk Security, an Israeli cybersecurity vendor. After a fantastic discussion about startups and creating product market fit, I asked him why he thought so many successful technology startups come from Israel.
Yeah, it's a combination of a few merits, I think, of the people here. One is basically the entrepreneurship kind of culture here, right? And it's been this culture since Israel was established as a country, right? In agriculture, in physical security of our country, right? And in this, really the innovation that comes here on every aspect. It's, I think, the importance we put here on an education and, you know, high quality education. It's also the fact that we are a very small country with very limited resources, and we always have to find ways to excel and make sure we can survive the tough neighborhood we live in with these limited resources. So we have to innovate all the time. At the country level, at the personal level, right? I mean, our market reach, our ability to use, you know, physical resources, the fact that we're like an island, it keeps this country culture-wise on its toes all the time. And that generates a lot of, you know, a lot of innovation just by the need to always be there on the cutting edge and making sure you're better and faster than everything else that is happening around you. And I think that these, you know, this cross of really being entrepreneurs in our nature, the level of education, it's really in our blood. And now add to it the fact that, you know, for all sorts of other reasons, like protecting our country, we had to create good technologies. It was an amazing incubation environment for an ecosystem that kind of amplified itself over the years, right? It created an ecosystem of specifically around cybersecurity that generated more cybersecurity generations. And I think about how many entrepreneurs and great companies came out of Checkpoint. How many great companies came out of Radware, right? How many companies came out of the bigger companies? How many second and third generations were created here?
My final guest on this look back at 2023 is Bob Ackerman, the managing partner of venture capitalist firm Allegis Cyber, one of the most successful technology VC firms and the first VC firm to specialize in the cybersecurity space. Their portfolio includes dozens of successful exits, including unicorn acquisitions and IPOs. I asked him what makes a great VC firm.
I'm an operator, right? So I've got some pretty hard belt and hard-earned perspectives on that question. Yeah, you go back, first of all, to the origins of the venture capital community. Who were the first venture capitalists? The first venture capitalists were all ex-operators that had a modicum of success in building their own companies and got to a point in time where, because of that success, they were sought out by next-generation entrepreneurs. Can you help me? Can you help me with capital? Can you help me pull a team together? Can you help me figure out how to build a business? Can you guide me? And that really was the genesis of so much of the venture community. And as venture capital, based on its success, continued to grow and that growth was compounded, we lost something along the way in my perspective. We lost that core of operating experience. We had a lot of very bright people managing a lot of money, but a smaller and smaller percentage of those partners in venture capital firms actually had operating backgrounds. And so, you know, my counsel, you know, our firm, whether it's Allegis, the entire team have operating backgrounds, Data Tribe, our foundry, where we start companies, all have operating backgrounds. My bias is towards venture capitalists with an operating background. As I tell people, unless you've laid awake at 2 a.m. going, how in the hell do I make payroll next month? You just don't know. You can't learn that at school. You can't read a book and pick that up. You have to really experience it. And so when you look at the venture capital community, venture capitalists by and large all have capital. It's largely a commodity. So now you start looking at the people behind the capital. What is their expertise? How can your partnership with them help you lower the risk, accelerate the growth of your company, anticipate where the minefields are, navigate those minefields successfully? So for me, I really focus on the people even more than the firm, in terms of who is the partner I'm going to be working with, what is their background, and what contribution can they make to my success? How do they keep me out of the ditches? How do they help me accelerate going forward, help me get the right team, the right strategy, anticipate the challenges, steer around the potholes? That's what I'm looking for. And I think by and large, you find that more often with ex-operating executives than you do with folks that may have very strong technical backgrounds from an academic perspective and have attended great business schools, but haven't really been in that CEO seat navigating through those choppy waters.
Well, that brings this reflection on 2023 to a close. All that leaves me to do is to thank all the amazing guests who came into the conference room throughout the year and gave so much value and advice. I also want to thank our incredible production team who worked tirelessly behind the scenes week after week to make me look and sound good. In particular, my incredible executive producer, Roseanne, without whom this podcast simply wouldn't appear in your feed every week. And finally, I want to thank you, yes, you, for downloading and listening to this podcast every week. Thanks to you, we've more than doubled our audience figures in 2023 and have cemented ourselves as one of the leading business podcasts and are committed to continue to provide you with great guests, great conversation, and great value in 2024. So, on behalf of my EP, Roseanne, my incredible production team, and all of our guests, I wish you a happy, healthy, and successful 2024. Happy New Year.